Fact, one out of every 6 men are sexually abused and molested as children. Yet it's almost never talked about in the church or even in our communities. As a sexual abuse survivor myself, I can tell you from experience, as devastating as the trauma of abuse can be, it's not the abuse that destroys lives. It's the secrecy and shame in keeping it hidden. So if you're a man or you know a man who has been a victim of sexual abuse, I want you to know you're not alone. If you need someone to talk to, please email me personally and confidentially at realmenconnect@gmail.com so we can set up a time to talk. That's realmenconnect@gmail.com. Because there is healing on the other side of abuse, and me and my guest today are living proof of that. Real Men Connect is next.
Welcome to Real Men Connect. Are you ready to be the extraordinary man, husband, father, and leader God called and created you to be? Then get ready to receive wisdom and guidance from some of the country's most respected men of faith as you learn everything you need to know to go from good man to great man, God's way. No judgment, no shame. Just real men with real challenges seeking real change. All for God's glory.
Hello, mighty men of God, and welcome to the Real Men Connect podcast, where we help good men become great men God's way. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Martin, and every week we interview some of the nation's most respected and accomplished men of faith to find out what it really takes to become the kind of husband, father, and spiritual leader God called and created us to be. And each interview session is packed with practical, proven biblical principles you can immediately apply in your relationships, on your job, and in your community. Guys, today we have with us Pastor Seth Shelley. And Pastor Shelley has pastored in Western Canada for the past 8 years. And he's currently the lead pastor at Maple Park Alliance Church in Quesnel, British Columbia, where his role is to provide counseling services, perform weddings and funerals, organize events for the community, and a variety of other things. Now, prior to becoming a pastor, Pastor Shelley spent 5 seasons as a forest fighter in Alberta, Canada, working on ranches and as a surveyor for the Mountain Pine Beetle Project. In these experiences, he's gained a love for the outdoors and adventure. And when he's not working, Pastor Shelley loves to spend time with his wife and 3 children exploring the outdoors, playing hockey, and canoeing. My type of guy. Now, guys, today's show has a special meaning for me, because it was one of the main reasons I believe God called me to men's ministry. And that's to discuss one of the most taboo and avoided subjects in Christian circles, and that's sexual abuse and the shame, guilt, and stigma attached to it, particularly when it comes to men. Now, unless you're new listener to our show and you haven't been following us for a while, you should already know my story by now and how I'm a survivor of sexual abuse. But it came at a very high price to me. And it's one of the main reasons why I launched the Real Men Connect podcast. And I wanted to take back and prevent Satan from taking from men what I allowed him to steal from me through years and tears by exposing and healing one of his most diabolical weapons that he uses to destroy men's marriages, their families, their lives, and even their future. And I'm sad to say that even to this point in our podcast, after 4 years, 4 years later, over 400 episodes and over 250 guest interviews, we've never been able to get even one Christian man to agree to come on the show to talk about this topic with me until today. And that man is Pastor Seth Shelley. So if you can, Warrior Nation, help me in welcoming to the Real Men Connect podcast my guest and a long-awaited answer to my prayers, Pastor Seth Shelley. Welcome to the show, Seth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I hope that that introduction, Seth, didn't put a lot of pressure on you.
Yeah. No, not at all.
That you're the first man and in the history of our show. And it was the reason why I wanted to do this show in the first place. And I just thought I'd be able to talk about a lot more. And I underestimated the gravity of this topic. And we talked and we prayed before I came on the air today. And I told you, we're not even sticking with our regular program. And while we ask man up questions near the end of the show, I'm already going to throw that out because there are a lot of questions, because you're it, dude. You're the only person I've been able to get to agree to come on the show who's a man. We had one female, but I've been trying for years to get men, Christian men, who have experienced it, not just know about it, but experienced it so they can relate and talk to men out there who may have experienced the same thing. Seth, obviously I brought you on the show to talk about the subject matter itself, but also to talk to you openly and honestly about your story, because everyone has a story. Please tell us what happened and what you experienced growing up as a boy. And after you've done that, we'll kind of unpack your story and we'll just talk openly and honestly like two dudes, man. And we'll do it transparently about our shared experiences. So kind of bring us up to speed, because you have a great TED Talk that you've done on this. But we know in TED Talks, one, you got to be very particular about the audience you're speaking to. And you also have to keep it in a short time frame. But I want you to kind of, I want to take the gloves off and let you kind of share and bring us up to speed on your story. And we'll dive into it. Go ahead, man.
I had a fairly typical childhood. I would consider it typical. I'm from a larger family. So I have four brothers and two sisters. So I'm from a family of seven. Grew up in a small farming community. My dad, you know, worked. My mom stayed home. And I enjoyed my childhood for the most part. And one of the things that happened in our family growing up is we had people over all the time. I had older siblings. So I was a kid growing up with these teenagers in the house. And so it wasn't uncommon to have people over and friends over, and my brothers would have their friends over. And so the house was always full, always teeming with people. And so that was just kind of the environment that I grew up in. Had a big family. My dad was from a big family. He was from a family that had, he had four brothers and two sisters. And we all kind of lived in the same community where my grandfather, my Baba and my Gigi in Ukrainian, they kind of had a farm that they started. And, you know, my Baba was raised by pioneers who settled in Western Canada after immigrating. My Gigi was the son of immigrants who came over from the Ukraine. So we were kind of steeped in this family culture of like just strong, powerful, you know, nothing's going to keep us down. Nothing's going to stop us. The joke was, you know, the Shelleys are taking over the world because all the families had big families. And, you know, we were real men, you know, and that's when my uncles talked. It's when my dad talked, just kind of in a way that like everyone was just kind of second to us. We were strong. My Gigi could do anything. He could fix anything. He could solve any problem. So that was kind of the like family I grew up in. Thinking that about myself as a Shelley boy, like I'm a Shelley boy. And we even had hats that were kind of a family thing, that these like cheese grater farmer hats had a tractor on it and said Shelley boys. And it was, you know, like we were the Shelleys, you know? And so one of the things that was what I kind of grew up in. And then, so what happened is my brother would bring his friend over, and this was the guy who groomed me, and he was about 4 or 5 years older than me. He groomed me. And then just in the busyness of our home, took advantage of that he was always around. He was always there. He saw that I was number five in the family. So I'm lower in the birth order, and I was desperate for attention. I liked attention. I liked being around older people. It kind of made me feel important, made me feel valued to, you know, carry on conversations with teenagers and adults. So at any rate, he groomed me. And then before I started middle school, so where we grew up, we went from kindergarten to grade six, and then you went to another school for grade 7 to 8, and then you went to another school for the rest of high school. And so right before I was kind of transitioning, I think I was in grade six, he kind of put it to me that like, hey, you know, are you nervous? This is part of the grooming. And I think anyone who's ever been, you know, sexually abused identifies with the grooming part. But like these kind of somewhat innocuous kind of like comments or things that get you thinking.
Testing the waters, yeah, and pushing the boundaries. And
so the biggest thing he did was like, are you prepared to have to change in front of people in high school? Like, that's something you have to do. Everyone gets naked in front of each other in the change room, which for me was like, no, what? I didn't know that. Like, nobody's told me that. And so that was just part of the grooming process. And that was kind of his first in. And then from there, it just led on to a summer. Luckily, it wasn't, you know, years. I do try and think positively about my experience as best I can, but it wasn't years, it was months. And that's where all my abuse began. And then so following that, I kind of had to now manage this fact that like something taboo had happened that I didn't know was possible. And I mentioned that in my TED Talk, and that's a real feeling. I had no idea that this was even something that could happen. Like, we'd never been talked about, I'd never learned about it. All of a sudden you're like, you're put in this foreign, you know, arena, and things are happening that you don't even know are possible. And then you have to live with that in the whole context of like, we're the strongest, we're the best, you know, we're manly men, and we're going to have big families, and we're going to, you know, we can do anything we want with our hands, and we can shape the land, and we can build things, and we can have families. And then now you're kind of thrown into this environment. It's like so foreign to that. So who do you even talk to about it? And then all these feelings of like, you don't feel like a man, you don't feel strong, you don't feel, they all just kind of compound and pile onto that. And so then the big turning point for me was I found out about someone I knew, a girl that I knew. She had come out and said that she was raped as well. And not by the same person, by somebody else. It happened at a youth retreat. She came out and said it. And this is about a year after, 2 years after, as I'm still trying to navigate through all this stuff after the fact. And man, the comments that were made about her, like, oh, well, she's going to be a drug addict. Oh, well, her life's over. Oh, well, she's ruined her life. Or, you know, like, oh, well, what'd she do to invite it? Or all these things. It's like, well, does that apply to me too? Like, is that the same for me? Like, am I just damaged goods? Am I just a spoiled goods? Like, there's no hope for me. And that really started to compound all the stuff before, you know, a couple years later, it was just started to pile on them. Like, well, I guess my life's over too. Like, I guess all these things that I don't really know about, it's just over for me. And, you know, if I tell anybody, then they're going to think the exact same thing about me. You know, they're going to think it's, you know, I'm just this weak, washed up, whatever, you know, used up, no good for nobody. And so that was terrifying, right? That was so isolating, which only made me not want to talk about it more. Like, it made me just want to be more quiet, because it's like, well, hopefully, and I remember having these thoughts, like, hopefully if I can just fake it long enough and then I'll become an adult. And once I'm an adult, I'll just forget about all this. Like, that's what I convinced myself, right? Like, I'm just going to get through today, just fake it, you know? And when I'm an adult, this will all just go away and I'll be fine. And so that was my whole teenage years. Meanwhile, struggling with depression, suicidal thoughts, you know, I could not be alone. I wanted to be with people all the time. I wanted people to be laughing at me. And so that was kind of my thing. Like, I became like a really funny guy, because if everyone was laughing, it was safe, right? I didn't have to worry about anybody asking me any serious questions. And that was kind of my escape mechanism of like, let's just get through this. And then when I'm an adult, I don't know why I thought that, but, you know, somehow it would just disappear and I'll be fine. So that's kind of my brief story, you know, kind of in a nutshell.
You know, as I listen to you share this, and guys, we're talking to Pastor Seth Shelley about the topic of male sexual abuse. And I'm looking at now, you guys can't see this, but I'm looking at Seth on the show right now on a Zoom call. And so we can see each other visually, but you can't. And Seth, if you don't mind me asking, I hate to put you out on blast, but how old are you?
I'll be 32 next week.
All right. And see, what I assume that you were a lot younger than me, which you are, 32. Now, I'm looking at this screen. Seth and I are looking at each other. I'm a 51-year-old black man who grew up in the projects in the ghettos of Liberty City in Miami, Florida. Seth is from Canada, grew up in a family of seven, had mom and dad there in the home, you know, had even a grandparents' influence and everything. You can't be, now you mentioned, and I mentioned in your introduction, you're outdoors person. Dude, I don't even like driving around with the windows down in my car. I'm a city boy. And what I'm trying to communicate to the listeners is that you can't get more different than we are right now. You can't get more different. But as you're sharing just some of the highlights of your story, everything you describe is exactly what I experienced. And there's no other way to explain that other than tell you that the enemy, Satan, has a plan to steal, kill, and destroy. And he doesn't come up with new tactics, because we're talking about generational differences, ethnic differences, geographical differences, you name it, even our family, the social differences that we've been exposed to and around. And yet what you were describing about, I thought exactly the same thing, Seth, that if I can just grow up. Because Seth, how old were you around this time? You said sixth grade. So you're talking about what, 10, 11?
Yeah, I would have been 10 or 11, just right before, you know, kind of in the peak of my pre-adolescence, you know?
Right. And see, and I was 12 when it first happened to me, and it went on for 3 years. And it went on for a few months with you, but the same outcomes as far as the ripple effects of it. When you described that, of thinking, man, if I can just get this behind me, if I can just get to adulthood, get past this, I'll be out of here. Now, what you chose was humor. I love the way you said the word escape, that when you feel trapped by this thing, this stigma, you do want an escape. And with you, it was escape through humor. Man, if I can, garner attention, I can make people laugh. Now, my escape was a little bit different. It was success and achievement. If I can get applause from everyone, so you wanted laughs, I wanted applause. If I can be affirmed, because I didn't grow up with a dad who affirmed me, so I was looking for the affirmation. And you can imagine, after being abused for several years, your self-esteem is in the toilet. You think you're worthless. So I decided, if I can just achieve enough and be the perfect kid that everybody brags on, he's such a good kid, he's this, he's smart, he's this, then maybe I can outrun my past as well. So to me, that's the first thing that jumps out, is how we experience the same type of emotions. And I got a lot more questions for you, Seth, but just starting that off, wow. I'm hoping that the men are listening to this to realize you're not a unicorn. Your situation is not different from everybody else's situation. The details of the circumstances, you was with a friend of your brother's, of your older brother. With me, it was a cousin, a family member that was close. But the details are different, but you can see the fallout is similar. And they're going to find that out as we continue to discuss this. Now, I'm telling you, I'm excited about talking to a brother about this, because I just can't get men to talk to me about it. So, Seth, let's kind of dive deeper into this. First of all, with the Me Too movement, when it initially happened, I don't know how you felt about it, but I was really hopeful that more men would come out of hiding. Now we know the Me Too movement, people got their opinions about that. And I'm thinking maybe even come alongside women and to admit that, I've been sexually assaulted and abused myself. And guess what I realized, Seth? I was being very naive. What I don't understand, I guess my question for you, what I don't understand is that even with it being there's more public display of empathy and compassion and acceptance for people who've gone through what we've been through, why does it still seem so difficult for men to step out of the shadows, so to speak, to speak up and get healing, if it seemed like people are more receptive to us sharing our story? Because you mentioned the young girl who mentioned that, said that, and you saw how they responded, but we're responding a lot differently today. Why do you think it's still a problem then? Why men are not speaking up?
Yeah. Well, first off, I just want to say, I commend the Me Too movement. I think it's a great movement. I know lots of people have opinions on it. I think at its face value, it's a good thing to get people talking about their stories and to identify. However, it's so steeped in stigma that it's inverted. It's not the same. And so for a woman, this is just my perception. I want to be careful how I say this, but when a woman
you got comes men out, listening to this call, don't worry.
When a woman comes out and says the Me Too thing, the culturally appropriate response is to lift her up. Only an empowered woman will come out and say this. It's an empowering act of, and we need to stand in solidarity with this strong woman. But it's inverted for men still, because the stigma, where it's like if a man comes out, it's not empowering. It's emasculating. It strips them of some sort of, title or status or whatever the stigma is. And so even in my experience, now I won't name any names, but when I did my TED talk, I had a few people approach me and say, how can you as a man talk about sexual violence? I said, well, what are you talking about? Well, you have no right to talk about it. You're a man. It's like, hold on a second. It happened to me. Wow. I'm not talking about it in a broad sense. I'm talking about my own story. Happened to me? But that's where it's inverted. So it's empowering for a woman to come out and say it. We get behind that, but it's still emasculating for a man to say it. And so lots of men come alongside these women and they say, yeah, you need to be empowered to share your story. But when it's flipped and say, why don't you share your story? They're like, there's no way I'm talking about this, because I've, this is probably true for most of the guys listening. If they're an adult like me, or maybe they're say around my age, because I know lots of these guys, they're around my age, 32, and they faked it enough that they think they're safe. So they're like, I'm not telling my story. I faked it to this point and things are going pretty good.
Yeah, I thought so too. Yeah.
And so on the outward expression, life's good for them. They've learned to just manage the guilt, the shame, the suicidal thoughts, the depression. They just learn to forget about it. So they think. And so they're like, well, I'm not going to share my story, because now all of a sudden everyone would just see me as this weak you know, and then all the things I've accomplished, all the things I've done, it'll all get stripped away and nobody will see that. And they'll only see me as a victim of abuse. And that's where the stigma is just too, it's too prevalent. And that's just not true in my experience. Like, I've had these conversations with men who've come and told me their story, and I don't look at them any less. Like, in the same way, I hope people don't look at me any differently. But, like, again, so when I first did my TED talk, one of the guys in the TED panel was like, oh, it's just so shocking. Like, you know, you've got a beard and you've got tattoos everywhere. You're this big, strong guy. Like, I never would have thought you. I said, what does that even mean?
What's that got to do with it?
It happened to me when I was a kid. Like, that. Yeah. I wasn't this. Like,
yeah, you didn't have a beard when you were a child.
What is that? How is it even relevant? But people can't get beyond that. Like, if you're going to be a victim of sexual abuse as a man, you have to be this weak, scrawny, pathetic little person. You can't be a normal man. Like, you have to be, doesn't happen to normal guys. And that's where it's just the stigma, right? So for women, it's empowering. It's like, good for you. For men, it's like, oh, I thought you were a strong guy, but you have a beard. I didn't think right. It could have been you. It's like, well, what does that even mean?
But, you know, that's a great transition to the next question I was going to ask you. Because, see, yeah, they're saying this rugged outdoor guy, beard and everything, which I think is kind of fun. Like you said, that wasn't you when you were 10, you know, 11 years old. But now my story is a little bit different, but it's the same problem, though, that I'm dealing with. See, now you can't see me right now on you just see part of me on the screen on a panel. But Seth, when I was a kid, I was still a kid, I was scrawny and skinny as a little child. But guess what? Even as a man now, I'm almost 5 foot nothing, 100 nothing. I'm about 5 foot five, 5 foot six on a good day if I'm wearing good shoes. So when men see me, they don't see this guy who's big and strong in stature. You know, they're amazed when they see me, the boldness that I project. But we know that comes from the Holy Spirit and what my identity in Christ. So during and after my abuse, I really struggled with my masculinity, my identity as a man, because my abuse made me question everything, Seth. You know, am I gay? Am I just weak because I'm a small guy and that kind of thing? Or am I just not a real man? Did you ever have to battle with those same questions growing up? And if so, how did you get the victory over that internal battle?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be lying to you if I said I still don't struggle with some of those, some of that thought process, because it's so prevalent. Like, it damages you in a sense that, like, that's a tool of the enemy to, like, strip away your foundation, your identity, like, who you are, and give you this false narrative. And that's what I'm really big on talking about. People living in these false narratives that aren't true, and, like, find your own story, like, find your narrative. And I believe as a pastor and, you know, fundamentally, that's found in scripture. Like, my identity comes in Christ first, not in anything that's happened to me. But at any rate, yeah, that's like, now I get to say that I experienced the same thing as you, because that's exactly what I had. And part of it is there's a physiological response that happens. And this is the uncomfortable part that people don't like to talk about, but there's a physiological response. You know, touch elicits a response from the body. And so as a kid, when these things are happening, that's leveraged against you by, it was for me anyways, and I know it's true for a lot of men that have been abused, that's leveraged against you that, oh, well, you responded, so you must be ... or you must have liked it, or you must have wanted it. And it's like, well, how do you tackle that as a kid without really having the information to understand that that's just a bodily response that actually I can't control in my brain? Like, I can't just say, don't do that. And, you know, that was kind of the spot for me that gave me a lot of confusion of, like, well, am I gay? Like, did I want this? Did I like this? You know, I mean, this is what I'm being told by someone who I trust, and this is what happened. So how do I reconcile those things? And then, so the idea of, like, well, I'll just grow up and get away from all this, it doesn't help, because those things are all still there in your brain. And yeah, I struggle with that idea of, like, well, who the heck am I then? You know, I don't really know who I'm supposed to be. I don't really know if I am what everyone says about me, like says about victims of abuse. Am I that person, or am I who my abuser tells me I am? Am I that person, or am I who my family tells me I am? Like, who am I? And then you're stuck in this kind of, like, this area of, like, I have no idea what my identity is. I don't know who I am. And I feel like I need to do things and act a certain way to find my identity, to, like, grab a hold of something. So that led to a lot of, you know, my teenage years seeking certain things out and, you know, pornography, all that stuff. And not even for, and I'm sure there's a lot of your listeners who can identify with this. And this is kind of a weird subject, but pornography in some ways for me wasn't even sexual. It wasn't even about the sexuality of it. It was like an affirmation that I'm not gay. Like, right, that's what I need.
Right.
I just need to prove to myself that I'm not gay. I need to prove to myself that I didn't like that, or that I didn't, you know. And it was just trying to just reinforce these things that I didn't know any other way to do it, because you're given these complex problems as a kid and you have nobody to help you figure it out. And it's like, figure it out. You know, that's, you know, figure a way through this. And there's no way to do it. There's no rule book. I didn't know anybody else who'd gone through this. I didn't talk to anybody about it. And so that left me with trying to come up with my own solutions. And so pornography was one of them. Like, I'm just going to reinforce to myself that this is not, you know, that I like this. That I like girl. I'm not gay. I'm not, you know, it's this whole, it was kind of a crazy, and I know lots of men that I've talked to have the exact same experience where it's like, yeah, it wasn't a sexual thing. It was trying to reaffirm. And again, like as a kid, as a teenager, a preteen, I didn't know what else to do. Like I had no idea. Like I'm given this complex problem and no tools to deal with it and nobody to walk through it with me. So I just came up with solutions as I could.
Now, man, we're talking to Pastor Seth Shelley, who's the lead pastor at Maple Park Alliance Church in Quesnel, British Columbia. And Seth, you're right on point with this. And as you're saying this, I mean, God, it's amazing. This is why I wanted other guys like you on the show, because it's reassuring when you know you're not the only one. You know we can't possibly be the only one, because the statistics prove it. One out of every six, now they're saying one out of every five men are struggling with this or have been abused, have been a victim of sexual assault. And it has affected your identity. You said something about how you were searching for an identity, and typically we'll grab onto anything that's going to give us comfort. And I can relate to you 100% when you said, wow, it wasn't the sex in the porn. It was to prove that, man, I don't like men. You know, I like women and I'm still attracted to women and they still turn me on. You know, but I want to ask you this before I get into a deeper question. How long did it take you before you finally told someone about your abuse, and who did you tell?
So the first person I told was a youth leader. And this was probably about three or four years after the fact. He was a guy that was one of my youth leaders, and we skateboarded together and had a lot of anger issues, and I would snap a lot. And that's the thing, right? Like, you bottle all this stuff in, you don't really control how it comes out. You kind of lose control. And so I'd have these emotional outbursts, angry outbursts, and I'd go from having everybody laughing and in stitches to all of a sudden just freaking out, breaking stuff and smashing windows, and just, I couldn't control my anger. And so he kind of, I don't know how, like he was only a couple years older than me, but he saw and recognized a pattern of behavior and just became my friend. And so I just felt like I could open up to him and talk to him, and nothing really came of it in the sense of, like, we didn't call the police or anything, but he was one of the first people I told, and he made me feel safe. He didn't make me feel weird. He didn't make me feel like I was an alien. And that was the biggest thing. Like, I had tried a couple years earlier, if I rewind a little bit, I tested the waters with a few people in my family, and it did not go well. And so it reaffirmed in my brain that, like, wow, you should not tell anybody, wow, anything. And I don't fault my parents or my siblings or anyone in my family. Like, it's, again, like, how do you, it's not talked about. There is no one telling you what to do. So they did their best, and I still love them, and I don't fault them, but it just reaffirmed their response. So, like, I shouldn't talk about this. This is something that I should just keep to myself, until a couple years later, when I was, it's actually right out in front of our church, just sitting there. And I know one of your biggest things is connecting and connecting men together. And that was what did it for me, was just having a connecting point of somebody. And I often tell people, you don't have to tell everybody, but you have to tell somebody.
Somebody, so right.
Find your somebody. Like, and he was my somebody, and we were friends, and we still are. And he's a pastor now as well. And so, yeah, it was just a safe place. And that, I didn't tell anybody else for another like 2 or 3 years after that. And by the time I did my TED talk, I think I'd only ever told 6 people. So I hadn't really talked about it a whole lot. But yeah, just, that was the first time I felt like, okay, this is not, he doesn't want to not hang out with me. He's not telling me to like leave. He doesn't think I'm weird. And he just was like affirming the fact that it sucked. He was like, man, I'm really sorry that happened. And that was the first time someone had said like, wow, I'm sorry. And it was like, whoa.
And it's not your fault. And
yeah, like, yeah. I didn't do this. Now, that didn't fix all my problems. Like I still had years and years of issues following that. But it was the first time that I really felt like, okay, I've got somebody that will be an advocate for me, you know?
You know, and Seth, this is why, you know, I kind of feel bad for you because I'm putting you on the spot because like Joe's been saving all this up for this one guy because I'm the first guy he can get on the show because I talk about it all the time when anyone addresses it with me. Because people ask me, they'll never tell me they've been abused, but they'll ask me about how I'm able to do what I do. And here's a great contrast, and I'm hoping by the Holy Spirit, thank you, Jesus, that somebody gets this. I asked you, I said, how long did it take? And you said, well, about 4 years. And you told this youth counselor, and because he gave you a safe place, but you tested it with your family members and not to throw them under the bus, because I did the same thing. Said, wait a minute. After you saw their response, I can't tell them this. They're going to go crazy, go ballistic. And in my particular case, when I was testing, I knew that if I outed this person, that I wasn't going to be taken care of. Because this person, the way he groomed me, he took care of me. That's how I was able to go on for so many years, because my mom had her issues, personal issues. My dad wasn't in the picture. So, of course, I'm prime for a person, for a predator to take advantage of. You know, I didn't see myself as being a prey to anybody. But I was afraid thinking, okay, if that person leaves, I'm not going to be taken care of. No one covered me in that sense that, okay, if you tell us the truth, we're going to make sure you're taken care of. You will eat, you know, you will have a place to live, that kind of thing. But something jumped out at me, and I'm hoping, Lord, help me, that the men will hear this. You said 4 years you told this guy, and then you said it was a couple years later. And now you said you're 32 now, right? And when did you do that TED Talk? How old were you?
I was 27. It was a couple years ago.
So you were young, 27 years old, doing that, which takes a lot of courage. Because, you know, TED Talks go viral. And I think you had, last time I checked, it was over 250,000 people had watched this video. And they said, wow, what bravery. Now, you know how long it took me to tell someone after those years that I was being abused? I didn't tell a soul until I was 33 years old. 19 years later. Now, you spoke up after just 4 years, and as painful it was, as scary as you did it, you're doing a TED Talk to over 250,000 people. Who knows how many other people have seen it or are not going to hear about it now. And now I have you on this show talking about it. You're talking about 5 years later, I have you on this show giving you this platform. It cost me a 16-year marriage. It caused me losing my wealth, risking my health by going into a full-blown sex addiction and becoming a serial adulterer. And I look back now and say, what if I could have had the bravery to do, the courage to do what Seth did? Just go to a youth. I was in the church as a kid, didn't tell a soul, didn't find anybody safe to share with. And so I look at the contrast, and I'm hoping that the men are hearing this. Well, look at Seth now. Look at Joe Martin. They're okay now, but they don't know what it cost me doing 19 years of silence. And we haven't even talked about what it cost you even in that brief period of time, but it cost you something. Now, but I guess my question is, to get us back on track, Seth, is we know now how important it is to tell someone. Our stories are examples of that. But how can we know who's safe to tell? You were testing the waters. I test the water. How can we know? And how do we get the courage that you found to find the right words to tell someone? I think it was very courageous of you at that. Yeah, you were still a teenager and you were able to do that. How can we do that?
Yeah. So I want to, I appreciate it. And I appreciate, you know, the thoughts of me being courageous. I don't look at myself and think that. Personally, I don't. I think, you know, and this is where my plea is to the men listening who maybe haven't experienced sexual abuse, maybe haven't experienced this. Like, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Andrew Nunn. So that guy is the courageous one, because he went out on a limb and asked a kid that he saw struggling some real questions. And that was the courageous part. Like, I think I was I don't know what I would say. I was just waiting for somebody to ask me. I just wanted somebody to ask me. I wanted somebody to just see that I wasn't doing okay. And so like the courage part, yeah, sure, there's courage in like having to share and be truthful, but there's a lot of courage in taking that chance and saying, hey, like something's not right. Are you okay? And that's something we don't want to do. I don't know why. It perplexes me. Like, we just don't want to be the people that ask those questions. And I mean, I've lost a few friends now to suicide, and I feel bad about myself because sometimes I haven't asked those questions that I know I need to ask. Like, I see a post on Facebook with my one friend, and like a week before he took his life, and I knew something was off. And even me, like, I don't like the term courageous, because I feel like a failure too. Like, I've missed those moments, but I'm not going to miss the next one. And that's my encouragement to the men listening. Like, don't miss the moments to ask your friend that hard question that is going to put you out on a limb. It's going to make, like, you're taking a big risk, but you need to ask those questions, because my guess is that the men dealing with this stuff are just waiting for somebody. Like, they're just waiting for somebody to see through the fakeness, to see past the mask, and to see who they really are, and to see the hurt and see the pain. And I think that's the courageous part. And yeah, like I still lose things. Like, there's still things I lose out on because of what happened to me. And so the only remedy I've actually found to make it better is to just keep talking about it, is to just keep sharing about it. And as those scales start to tip and I'm losing less and gaining more, the more and more I talk about it. And one of the biggest things I did that helped me was I journaled a lot. So the first person I really had a conversation with was myself. So after I told Andrew, a couple years later, I started journaling. So I was 18, my first year firefighting, and I had all this time. We were in Helena, Montana on Man Up, you know, just sitting around waiting for fires to happen. And I had a journal, and I thought, well, I'm just going to write down my life story. And that really helped me start seeing things that I could start realizing weren't true. Like, I would write them down about myself and be like, that's not me. And then it really helped me start to have the conversation with myself about what's true, what's not, and made me more confident to share my story with people. Like, hey, I now have a firm grip on who I am and what's a lie and what's true. So now I can feel more confident to share. But yeah, that's kind of my encouragement. I think real courageous people are those guys that are going to ask those questions.
And Seth, this segment alone has been a blessing to me, because I know how important what you just said. And if men who have not experienced this or don't understand what you just said, is very powerful, because I now feel like you're even challenged me, because I told you how I struggle getting men to step forward because I'm sharing my story. And I think I need to be more bold in asking them about theirs and not just saying, what's your story, Seth? But have you ever experienced sexual abuse as a child? Now, it doesn't mean they're going to say yes, but we have to give them that open lane, because that's all they may be looking for is an opportunity, a chance. And if we're survivors of this and we're not asking those questions, then you're right. We're not being very courageous. We're not giving them a chance to step up and step through their pain and their hurt and sharing it. And another thing you mentioned too, that I thought was very, very really powerful. You said you journal. I used to write poetry. That was my coping mechanism. And I mean, I've published it in a book, and it's some dark stuff, you know, that I used to write about. And I see now, and people say, why would you include those poems in your book? Because I want you to see my whole life in my progression of how I grew out of that. But you just gave me another idea that I think that I could recommend to men too, that if you can't tell somebody about it, why not write it down? As somebody you can trust, say, can I show this to you? Can you read it? Then the words don't actually have to physically come out of you, because we know it is hard. I remember once I was able to open up my mouth, man, it's like the clouds parted. And I realized, just like you said, Seth, that the more I share, I could not change the past. Can't prevent it from happening anymore. There's nothing I could do about it. But I was shocked that the more I talked about it, the stronger I got. And it seems so counterintuitive, because it's so embarrassing. It is so stigmatized. And what you feel as a result of it, you think, I can't tell a soul about this. But it's just the opposite. God is saying, trust me. The more you say, you overcome by the power of your testimony. And the more you share it, the stronger you grow. Now, I got to share this with you, Seth, and I have a question behind it. when I first told my son, I told you, I waited. You're talking about, man, too long. You're talking about 19 years after I pretty much lost everything. And I was going through my divorce and I knew I had to tell my son, because now I'm about to lose everything and I might lose my son over this as well. And I finally told my ex-wife about it. So I got married still carrying the secret. And again, and how, you know, you went to humor. I continue to do it with success. I mean, I just achieved a lot of success, overachieving success, thinking that's going to cover my pain. That didn't. But I told my 9-year-old son about my abuse. And the first thing he asked me with tears in his eyes, Seth, was, Daddy, why didn't you tell someone? Why didn't you tell someone? And I told him with tears in my eyes that it was because of fear, which, Seth, I'm sure you can relate to, what's going to happen to me if I do tell somebody. I told him that it was had a lot to do with guilt of why didn't I stop it when I knew it was wrong. I told him that I struggled with shame, that somebody's going to judge me by this, or I'm going to get blamed for it. It was my fault that it happened. So, Seth, my question to you is, how did you deal with the fear and the blame from the abuser? Because typically our abusers make blame us and make us feel guilty. How did you deal with the blame and the shame and guilt after the fact? How did you deal with that?
Well, probably not very well. Now I've learned to deal with it a little better, but after the fact, it was just, it was hard to do, like, differentiate between all, like, the different things. It was all one big thing to me. And so I just tried to ignore it. That was the worst part, just trying to ignore it. But now what I do is I'll like talk to myself. And a self-talk is a huge thing that I'm big on. I was just talking with a guy last night, went for a walk, and we were discussing self-talk. Like, you have to change how you talk about it. And so one of the things I equate it to is, like, you're not a character in somebody else's story. This is your story. You're writing it. So I had to change the script. And that was the biggest thing. Like, all the things that, like, the reason I had guilt, the reason I had shame, the reason I had fear were because I had been convincing myself, or at least talking to myself, as if these were things that I had invited or asked for or done. And I had to start reframing that and be like, I did not do this. I did not ask for this. I did not want this. So the guilt, the shame, it's not mine. It's somebody else's. This doesn't belong to me. Like, I'm a victim. I'm not the person. Like, I don't have a part in this. I don't have a stake in this. This is just something that someone did to me. So that was part of the way I started to deal with it. It's still the way I deal with it. Like, I have to pause and remind myself even now, like, no, this is not something that I did. I didn't want this. Like, I didn't choose this. It's what happened. And I'm going to live in the realm of that, but I didn't ask this. So what am I guilty for? I didn't do anything wrong. What do I have shame for? I didn't do anything wrong. And oftentimes when I have conversations, people will ask me, you know, well, don't you just feel so dirty? Don't you just feel so, you know, whatever? And it's like, no, I don't. I don't feel those things because I didn't do those things. Like, if someone T-bones you driving down the highway, people don't come up to you and say, well, how does it feel being a bad driver? Do you feel right. You feel guilty because you're the worst driver in the world? It's like, I didn't do this. Somebody hit me. So I just try and rewrite the script a little bit and look at it differently. Like, I'm not going to look at this the way I did when I was a kid. And because when I was a kid, I thought I was like a 50-50 partner in this. And so then I did feel guilty and I did feel ashamed because I was like, what have I done? Now I'm like, I didn't do anything. Like, somebody groomed me. Somebody preyed on me. Somebody found me in a vulnerable state and took advantage of that. Like, I'm not gonna have guilt for that. And we don't do that. And that's part of the stigma. Like, if you draw parallels to this and other things in life, like car accident or like someone's house getting broken into, like, we don't throw guilt and shame on those people. We're like, oh, it's not your fault, you know. But when it comes to sexual abuse, especially with men, somehow it's like we have to. And like,
what did you do?
not to like reject the question, but like, part of what I've done is to just be like, I don't have to answer those things. Like, I am not the guilty party. I'm not. So like, I'm the victim. I'm the guy that got T-boned. I'm not the guy that ran the red light. So I don't need to apologize or try and work through. And I know that's maybe the way I deal with it. It might not be the best way to do it. I don't know. But it's the idea of like, I just have to change the narrative. Like, I don't have a stake in it. I didn't invite this. I didn't ask for this. I'm a victim. Like, I'm the person that this happened to.
Seth, I love it, man. No, this is excellent. This is excellent. Man, we're talking to my guest, Pastor Seth Shelley, the lead pastor at Maple Park Alliance Church in Quesnel, British Columbia. And no, Seth, you're right on point because no, you're absolutely right. We don't do this to other victims. And I was thinking, well, I'm taking notes as you're talking. I'm thinking this is good stuff. And I think this is going to be one of those archivable episodes that I can refer to men years from now, because they need to hear this plain talk. We're not talking clinical. We're not talking about psychology. We're talking about real talk about something that HAP does. And I wrote down here my notes. I said, next to, I'm talking about the most soothing words that we can, a person who's gone through sexual abuse can hear from another person is, me too. That's why we need to share our story. Yeah, you know what, Seth? Me too, man. I've gone through the same thing. But you just hit the second one. I love, it's not your fault. This happened to you, but it doesn't define you. This happened to you. So if you want to know how to respond to someone, and I'm talking to the men out there who are listening now, who have dealt with this, or you know someone personally who is struggling with this, if you've gone through it yourself, let them know that you have too. That'll go a long way in helping them, but also remind them that it's not their fault. Now, Seth, I'm looking at the time. I don't care how much time we're going to get this in, even if it kills me, because this is great stuff. Now, I want to now, along that same vein, I want to ask you this. How should men respond to either the lies they believe or what others say about them, not from who to blame, but I'm talking about when they hear, and you said you experienced this with the young lady who had opened up about what she went through. You know, when they hear the lies like, you'll never have a normal relationship, you're going to be messed up forever, you're damaged good and nobody is ever going to want you, your future is done now. What do you say to them if a person is believing that about themselves, not blaming themselves anymore, but realize they're thinking now, this has ruined my future?
Yeah. So I like to... most of the time, if I'm at that point in a relationship with somebody, like a friendship or a mentorship or whatever, I'm hoping that we can have a conversation. So that's the biggest thing, I think, is talking, is that connecting point, like, let's just have a conversation. And so what I like to do is I like to confront the narrative or confront the lie with a question. So why is that true? Why are you damaged goods? And then can you answer that? Like, and so again, like a couple of days ago, I was talking with a guy and he's going through different things, life things. And, you know, basically he's like, well, I have to just restart everything in my life. I have to restart everything. It's like, well, why? What does that mean? You know? And then as we start talking about it, he's like, well, I guess I don't have to restart everything, you know? So it's just confronting it head on. So if someone believes that, if I'm talking to somebody and they feel like, and I've had these conversations, believe me, like people saying, well, I'm just no good. Like I'm just damaged goods. I'm dirty. I'm whatever. I'm ruined. It's like, why? Explain to me why. And they usually can't. It's usually like, well, I don't know. It's like, well, then why do you believe that? Well, just because that's what people say. It's like, well, who says that? Who says
right.
that?
Like, right.
And then, so like just hitting it head on. And oftentimes those open questions, those leading questions, they really start to get your brain engaged. Because what happens is we just fall into the, you know, my dad told me this when I was a kid, like a river grows crooked because it takes a path of least resistance. It doesn't ever fight. It just goes the easiest way. And then it goes crooked. And so this idea of like, we have to engage in the work, but oftentimes we take the easiest route of just accepting what other people say because they must know more than us. Or especially if you've been a victim of grooming and abuse, like that's what happens. You accept what somebody else is saying is true because they must know more than me. And so we just have to confront those things. And we got to put in the work to ask those questions. Like, why do I think that? Why is that true? Is this true? So if someone came to me and said, you know, my future is just ruined, like I'll never have a normal relationship now. It's like, well, why? Well, I don't know, because I got abused. Well, what does that have to do with your relationships? Why is that going to ruin your relationship? Is your abuser part of this relationship? Well, no, I haven't seen them in 10. You know what I mean? Like just unpacking it to the point where it's like putting them back in the driver's seat. And so I know for a fact in my own life, the abuse took me out of a position of control. I wasn't in control and I wasn't able to. And so the lie was that I'll never be able to have control and that something is wrong with me. And normal people wouldn't let somebody take their life over like this. Normal people wouldn't let someone So there must be something wrong with me. But then once you get back in the driver's seat and you can see, like, I actually have the ability to make decisions and I have the ability to, like, direct my own path and steer my own future, then it's like, well, I don't need to believe that other stuff then. And that's where I find most men are at. They just feel like they don't have a say. They're either stuck living with a cultural, societal view of manliness that they're trying to live up to. That's an impossible goal they can't live up to, or they're stuck in that pattern of abuse and grooming where they think that this is somehow still their fault and they can't navigate. And so they're not even steering the ship. They're just kind of floating along. And then of course it feels like, well, what am I going to do? I can't do anything. So it's just those questions, those simple leading open questions to get the brain starting to think again and answering these things. And there's a power behind words, like saying something out loud has a tremendous amount of power. And I'm not saying, like, you know, name it and claim it, that kind of stuff. I'm just saying, if you can actually say yourself, if you're out there listening and you are a victim of abuse, if you can walk up to the mirror and look yourself in the eye and say, this is not my fault. I didn't do this to myself. There's a power in saying that out loud that you'll hear it and you'll be like, oh, wow, that might be the first time you've ever heard that said. Maybe you have to be the first person to tell yourself that.
Tell yourself, yeah.
There's a power in it, because then you can start engaging and breaking out of these, like, one-liners that you have been living under and say, this actually isn't true. I'm actually not damaged goods. Like, I used to think that. I've been married for 12 years coming up in August. And I used to think that, like, well, my marriage is just going to fall apart. Like, I'm never going to be able to stay married. Like, I'm going to ruin my life. I'm going to ruin my marriage. I'm going to ruin my kids' lives. And then it was like, wait a second. Like, I have been married now at that point for, like, 7 years. Like, things are going good. I have a good family. I have a good life. I have a wife who loves me. Like, I have a, these things aren't true. Why do I believe them? Like, why am I projecting these things onto things that aren't even real? Like, my wife loves me. My kids love me. I'm a good dad. I'm a good husband. I don't need to just accept the fact that because this happened to me when I was 10, well, everything's out the window. I'm just going to wait for the other shoe to drop. Like, maybe I'm off on a little tangent. Sorry.
No, but Seth, you're right on point, because we have to question our reality. That's basically what you're saying. We have to question our reality. I told you that because of my silence, I really suffered. And by the time I ruined my life, I had to go through recovery. And, you know, in recovery groups, 12-step programs, Celebrate Recovery, they have you identify with your, quote, addiction. You know, my name is Joe. I am an alcoholic. Oh, my name is Joe. I am codependent. Oh, my name is Joe. I'm a sex addict. And I stopped saying that when I went through recovery. And when they would ask me who I was, I say, my name is Joe. I said, I'm a sinner that's been saved by the grace of God, and I am holy and righteous to him. And people ask me afterward, they said, why would you say that? I said, because I'm only going to believe what God says about me.
Yeah, exactly.
Not what you say, not even what I think sometimes, but what he says. So if it doesn't line with what he says about me, then I'm not going to accept it. And so you're absolutely right. We got to ask more questions. Whatever that is, we believe. You'll never have a normal relationship. Does God say that about you? You'll be messed up forever. Does God say that about you? You're damaged goods and nobody's ever going to want you. Does God say that? You're his beloved child. Your future is over. Does God say your future is over? He says, I know the plans I have for you to prosper you, not to harm you, but to give you hope in the future. So who are you going to believe? The lies of the enemy and the world and how he's attacking your mind? Or are you going to believe what I said? You know, so I think you're right on point. We got to start not just accepting face value every thought that just pops in our head, or everything that society tells us about ourselves.
Because there's one other lie that I think we need to confront. And it's not a lie that I think is, it's a lie, but I don't know if it's insidious in the same way. But there's a lie in the church, and I've got a perfect scripture that fits with this. But this is one of the things I've run into in my life as a pastor, as a minister. There's a lie in the church that somehow if you're just in church, if you're just with Jesus, it's fine. You don't, like, everything will be good. Just be quiet.
Yeah, you don't have to talk about this. Don't have to say,
you don't have to talk about
it. Don't bring it up again.
Jesus has healed you. So, like, and I hear that a lot. Like, why don't you just give it to Jesus and take it to the cross and let Jesus deal with it? Cast your burdens upon him and he'll deal with it. And it's like, okay, that's true, but it's not entirely true. So my favorite portion of scripture in regards to this is found in Luke chapter 8. So I won't go through the whole thing, but this is Jesus when he cast the demons out of the demoniac. And so he goes, he casts the demons out. And my favorite part is it's just two verses, but it's such a good snapshot of what Jesus wants you to do if you're like that demoniac. So let's just say that equates to me. I've been possessed by this fear, the shame, this guilt. I'm free of it now. So the demoniac, the guy's been healed. He begs Jesus in verse 38, in Luke chapter 8, verse 38. The man whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him, but Jesus sends him away. So right there, that's a great spot. What does Jesus say to him? Return home and tell how much God has done for you. So the man went away and told all over town how much Jesus had done for him. So I love that, because here's a guy who's been healed and he just wants to go with Jesus. He's like, Jesus, just take me with you. And Jesus says, no, don't come with me.
That's right.
I don't want you to come with me. I want you to go back home.
Go share your testimony. Yeah, go tell about the good things. Yeah.
Go tell everybody who knew who you were and can see who you are now. And so in church, we have this thing. It's like, okay, I've dealt with this. I've dealt with this stuff. I'm just going to sit here now and be with Jesus. And Jesus is saying, I got to be careful how I phrase this.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
But Jesus is saying, I don't want you to just sit here.
I didn't tell you to do that. Like, I didn't say everybody. That. Right.
You know, and so in church circles, the most receptive place I've ever shared my story, and this is sad, and I think you can relate to this, has not been church. It's not been the church
world. Yeah, man.
Looks at it like, well, that's great, but let's move on. It's like, no. There's so many people out there that need to hear about this freedom in our own church circles that I don't want to just move on. I don't want to not talk about this. Like, Jesus has instructed me to go and tell everyone, because a lot of my healing, most of my healing, that I tried my own way, it didn't work. It left me in a pretty bad spot. And the rest of it has all been by the power of the Holy Spirit. It's been through scripture. It's been through community. It's been through engaging with, like you said, these truths that are in the gospel. Like, who does God say I am? Like, if I feel like I'm used up, well, great, because he's made me a new creation. You know, if I feel like I don't have anything good inside me, great. He's asked me to become sanctified and he's going to fill me with his Holy Spirit. I don't need to worry about what's inside of me. Like, all these things that, like, I can lean on in scripture. Yet, however, in church, in the church circle, we don't want to talk about this. We don't want to address it in the sense that we're fine with people coming up and being prayed for healing. We'll have an altar call and come and be freed and come and be healed. And then that's where we leave it. And then we say, now just go be a good disciple, go be a good follower of Jesus. Yet Jesus, when confronted with this man, says, don't come with me, go home, tell everybody, go tell. And the guy's like, okay. And so how many people, you know, came to understand Jesus as the Messiah? We don't know, because that's where his story ends. But how many people came to know Jesus as the Messiah because this demoniac came back and was like, look, this guy is the real deal. He healed me. I'm here to tell you about it. And so we have this huge ability as the church right now. We've got the answer. We're just not talking about it. So we've got the people who can engage with the healing, but we don't want them to share about it. And I think we look at the hurt in our world. We look at all the stuff going on and the Me Too movement and all this stuff. And the church has a vital role to play in that. And it's simply just in sharing the good news of what Jesus has done for you. So for me, my testimony isn't, it's not this crazy, amazing story in the sense that I should be the only one sharing it. Like, I don't want to be the poster boy. And I said that after my TED talk, like, I don't want to be the poster boy for this, because this happens to so many people, that I just want to be another person who has come out and found strength and healing. I don't want to be the only one. I want to be part of the masses. And so that's where that part in Luke, that idea of Jesus just saying, go tell people.
And Seth, you know, it's not the only time in the Bible where that happens, where after Jesus offers healing and you hear the woman say, but let me tell you about a man who I met, the woman at the well. There's so many different stories of people going back to say, let me tell you about my encounter with Jesus. Let me tell you, because he gets the glory out of this. He said, we overcome by the blood of the Lamb and the power of our testimony. But you got to share and open your mouth to share your testimony. You know, I already told you we were going to go over time today, Seth, but I told you, man, I am so thrilled to have you on the show, because I feel like, man, I can finally talk to somebody who's not, you know, ashamed to talk about this. You know, this is a very heavy topic, but yet we're talking about it laughing. And I know I can take you back. We got a big age gap between us, But we never, I never even imagined that I could talk to somebody about this and even laugh about the experience and what I used to believe about myself and what I thought about myself. You know, it's just amazing that what God can do if you trust him enough. I have a saying that I say that God will choose to heal what you reveal. He will only choose to heal what you reveal. He will address what you confess. He wants us to open up his mouth, our mouth, so he can show his power through us and what he can do for us. But I tell you, I don't care about the time. I still want to get my questions answered.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you this. How should you, and this is a very tough question, Seth. How should you, as the person who was abused, deal with the potential fallout of the other people? I'm talking about from your family members and even their family members of the person who abused us, after you open up about your abuse. Because a lot of time we don't speak up because how we think is going to impact others who know us, who know them, who love us and love them. You know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
How should we deal with that touchy subject, that the fallout of what are coming out, telling somebody about this, even years later, because now you've outed this person and that impacts a lot of people, including the people who love us. So what do you suggest?
Yeah, that's a really hard one. And it's so hard because of every instant is so different and varied. And while there's so much the same, there's all these complexities and variables, and it's tricky. I mean, it's a hard one. And I think in my brain, and this is the advice I've given to people, is like, if it's the way to address it on the onset is through the lens of redemption. So like redemption and restoration. So how can I do this to not compound the problem? Because what I find is like, it's like carrying around this weight, you know, you got shame, you got guilt, you got all this stuff. And so what we want to do is just give it to somebody else. I'm like, well, I don't want to take this anymore. Why don't you take it? And that's what I've seen a lot play out, is like the abused person just wants to heap all that stuff on whoever, whether it's their family, you know, somebody to blame, somebody else, just take this. I don't want to carry it anymore. And so that's what I would steer people away from. And so the idea of like doing it with a redemptive lens, with a restorative lens, that doesn't mean that you're trying to redeem and restore the person that abused you. Like sometimes that's just, you can't do that. But rather the idea of like, I'm working my way towards healing and wholeness, and I want everybody around me to be on that path as well. And so I'm going to only do this through the lens of a redemptive, restorative process. So I'm not trying to drive a wedge in between, you know, me and my family. I'm not trying to drive a wedge. I'm just going to share with you what happened. I want you to know that my goal is redemptive. I want this to be, and we see this in scripture, right? This arc, this narrative of redeeming and that making these things redeemable. And that's really hard. And so, but then it takes a lot of thought, and it's a lot harder than just blaming. And it's a lot harder than just blaming somebody and passing on the guilt. And so for me, in my instance, it's taken years of conversations and at the right moment and at the right time and having conversations with my brother. Like my brother, it was his friend. It's been years of having conversations with him to remind him that like, I don't blame him. I don't hate him. I don't hate you. Like, but we need to have this conversation because I have things that I need to say to you, but I want you to understand that like, I don't blame you. Like this was not your fault either. I'm not looking. And that's the thing. I'm not looking for somebody to be at fault. I'm looking for people to get healing out of this. And ultimately I that even extends to the person who abused me. I don't think that's necessarily possible. I don't think I can do that, but that's my framework. It's not revenge. It's redemption. So how do we redeem this? How do we take this complex family element and all the things and the community impact? And how do we work through this in a way that we all get to come out on the other side, if we choose to, better than we were on the other side of it?
Seth, this is excellent. I'm glad I asked you that question. I know it was a really tough question, but you did a splendid job in doing that, because I wrote down in my notes here, you said redemptive and restorative, doing it from a pure heart, and where I call it being father filtered as you do it, because there is a way to do it redemptively and restoratively, not doing it in revenge. God didn't tell us to seek revenge. He said, vengeance is his. But we can, and he says, what? Blessed are those who are the peacemakers. Blessed are those. And so it shows that we're sons of God. So I love that. I'm glad I did ask you that, but I knew it was going to be a tough question. And I got two more questions. We've gone way past time, but I got two more questions. And they're going to be, the first one is going to be a little bit tough. All right. But I don't know. I think the Spirit wants me to do this. I mean, I was led by the Spirit to ask this question. Here's the first one. I want you to speak to that man who's still hurting others. Seth, we're not naive. We're not naive to think, oh, only the people, only the men who are listening to this. We're talking about over 1.2 million downloads of this podcast. I'm not naive, and you're not naive to think that there's not a man out there who's engaged in sexual abuse right now with a child. It breaks my heart, but I know it's happening. I'm not going to be that naive. And we know that a lot of abusers of children have been abused themselves, including the person who abused me, my cousin, your brother's friend, possibly. We're pretty much sure that they did experience some abuse. So what would you say to the man out there who's listening to our podcast, who has either sexually abused someone in his past, or he's currently abusing someone right now? What would you say to him right now?
Yeah, that is a tough question. Likely what I would say is that I'm sorry if they experienced something that's made them feel like this is the only option they have. I would say I'm sorry that you've experienced something in your life that makes you feel like this is an escape. And I would encourage them that they don't have to continue in this, and that they are the driver. They're not just being drug along. And so they have an opportunity, and it's going to be a hard opportunity. It's not going to be an easy one. But I believe if they are the ones who take the opportunity to stop what they're doing and to confess and to share, it's going to be a lot easier for them and for everybody else than if they get caught or they get found. Or ultimately they've got to answer to God. So I think if they can, you know, but that's a really hard one, because my mind goes to so many different areas and anger and pain. But I mean, I've said that about my abuser. Like, in some ways I feel sorrow. I feel really sad that this person thought that was the only thing they could do to ease their own suffering and pain. And in the same way, it's very similar to the last question. They're just trying to pass on whatever pain and fear and shame that they have, and they're not doing it in the right way. They're doing it in a vengeful way and not a redemptive way. And I do believe that it's still redeemable for them. Like, they're not too far gone either. They're not so far gone. Like, that's my big thing. Like, well, I'm not the sum total of what's happened to me. Well, you're also not the sum total of what you choose to do. And you can make a choice today to stop what you're doing and to work towards correcting it. Now, there's still ramifications, obviously. Like, you've still caused harm and damage, but that's a tricky one.
You know what, Seth? When I wrote that question down, I said, I'm going to ask Seth, and I'm saying, God, that is a tough question to ask. And of course, you know, God put it on my heart. And he says, Joe, what would you say to your abuser? He's never confessed. He's never come clean, and we've outed him, but he said, if you could see him, what would you say to him? And what I would say to him, and I'm saying this to the person who, because I agree, I love what you just said, that there's hope for you. God has not given up on you yet. But people have asked me, Joe, what would you say? And I said, God said, what would you say to him? And this is what I would say. First of all, I would tell him, I've forgiven you. That I've forgiven you. And I would ask him, do you know Jesus? Because if you don't, let me tell you about him. And what he's done for me, in spite of what you did to me. And what you meant for evil, he used for good. And I've forgiven you for that. And even when you were abusing me, you weren't just abusing me, you were abusing him. Because he says, what you do to the least of them, you've done unto me. So I would say, I'm praying for you to know him. And like you said, Seth, in his redemptive and restoration power and his healing power, because I've already forgiven you, but he needs you to confess to him so he can heal you. This is a tough question, Seth, but I'm hoping that we've done it some justice, because I don't know who's going to listen to this and who's listening to us right now, or who somebody might share this episode with someone who listens to this. And we're praying for the Holy Spirit to do what only he can do the way that he does it. And I'm hoping that it's going to set some people free and stop this madness and what it's doing to children who, like you say, are growing up blaming themselves for all of this. And Seth, even though that was a tough question, that's why I didn't want to end this show on that question. So I'm going to end it with this question as we close.
Sure. I'll just say one more thing.
Go right ahead, man.
If you don't mind. I don't know the data, the science or whatever behind abusers, but I know it's the same with the addicts and alcoholics. A lot of times what they say is like, well, I've just done so much already. Like, it's just so much work to go back. But that's the beautiful picture of grace. You can take a million steps away from God, but it's just one step back.
One step back.
You don't have to go back those million steps.
Right.
It's just one step. It's just
turn. Isn't that awesome?
And that's the amazing part about it. So for those people listening that might be in that cycle, it's not, don't hedge your bets and say, well, I've already invested this much time into it. Like,
right.
Just take a step back. Just turn around. He's right there. He's ready. He's willing. You know, and there's going to be a community of people that are willing to walk and work through that with you, that redemptive and restorative process.
Yeah. And, you know, it's the reason why they call it amazing grace. It's amazing grace. I love the way you put that. Yeah. Even if you've taken a million steps away, all it takes is one step back with grace, man. And like the prodigal son, when he saw him in the distance, he ran towards him. He didn't wait for him to get all the way back. He ran towards him. And oh, I love it. I love it. So let's close this out. This will be my last question. And I'm hoping that the men will forgive me for going over our time, but I think it was worth it. Well worth it. At least I believe it was, Seth. Can you tell us why it's so important for us as men, especially those who've been sexually abused, to share their stories with others, regardless of how painful it is? Because, Seth, I want you to close it out with this, because there's still some men who said, Seth, Joe, I hear you. Dude, I just can't. I can't make myself do this. I just can't get myself to do this. And Seth, I'm putting you on the spot because I know it's going to be the work of the Holy Spirit within him, but give me your best way of convincing that man out there who just thinks it's just too painful. Because Seth, I've had men 60-something years old come up to me after a conference and tell me, Joe, I was sexually abused too, and you're the first man I've ever told. And my heart broke for them because I'm thinking, how much has it cost them to wait that long? So Seth, convince this man out there who's listening to this why it's so important in to open up and to share his story.
Yeah, so I mean, somewhat, I kind of think of myself, not to be selfish, but I think, okay, what did I need when I was a kid? Like, what would have helped me as a kid just come out right at the beginning and not have that huge lag of time of trying to figure it out? What would have helped me? You know what it would have been? It would have been seeing somebody who was 32, who liked to hunt, who liked to canoe, who had a family and had a job, had a career, you know, just talk about it. And not in the gory details, but just talk about it. Like, if I knew that there was an older guy in our church community, or in our whatever, who had gone through this and was willing to open up and was open about it and still was living a, you know, quote unquote, normal life, and he wasn't this wrecked, horrible person, he wasn't cast out of society, I would have felt so much more confident. So my encouragement is, like, think about yourself at the time when it happened to you. What did you need? You didn't need necessarily Batman to come and save you. You didn't need a superhero. You needed somebody that you could just look at and say, wait a minute, that happened to him too. I can talk to that guy. And so now the damage is done for me. Like, it's happened to me. So I look at it and think, what I'm trying to offer is a limb a branch, whatever, for that person that it's happening to right now. And I'll tell you, just anecdotally, this is just from my experience, but as I've opened up and shared about it, as I've talked about it, I have had lots of younger people, people that are younger than I was when I shared about it, seek me out, find me, and I encourage them to just begin that process. And I mean, I like to think of myself as a somewhat normal person. And it's that idea of being a role model. Like, yeah, you know, you can play hockey and still be a victim of sexual abuse. You can be a hunter and still be a victim of sexual abuse. Like, your life, this is not a death sentence. This is not, it's not over for you. And it's something that happened to me, and I've worked through it, and I'm working through it, and I'll be here to help you with it. And that's what I think. What did I need? I just needed somebody that I knew to make me feel like I wasn't alone. Because part of the silence is that you just feel like you're the only one. And that's my encouragement to those guys out there that are just not sure they want to talk about it yet. Again, you don't have to tell everybody. You don't have to tell all the details, but you have to tell somebody. And when you make yourself open, when you make yourself available, nobody's ever asked me the gory details. I've never told anybody the gory details. You know, I've told a few people, my counselor and stuff, but nobody asks those questions. I think that's part of the fear too. Like, people are going to want to know, you know, what did he do? What did he touch? What did you have to do? Nobody wants to know that. Most of the questions I get are like, how'd you do it? Like, how'd you get here? You know, have you struggled with suicide? Yes, I have. And they're like, oh man, me too. Have you struggled with this? Yes, I have. Have you struggled? They don't care about, you know, what's happened. They just want to know that, like, is there someone here that I can relate to? Like, do I got somebody that will walk this through with me? And that's my biggest encouragement. Like, what did you need when you were a kid? I know what I needed when I was 10. I idolized my family. I idolized my church community, maybe to a fault. Like, I loved my church. I loved my pastors. I loved the people in the church. And then I found myself on the outs when this happened, because I couldn't find anybody in this area, this sphere that I loved, that I wanted to be part of, that was like me. There was nobody like me. I thought I was the only one. And if I had just known that there's one person in my church who is, I would have gravitated towards them. I would have told them right away. And so that's my encouragement. Like, what is that version of you need? They need someone who's just going to have the, and this is where it is courageous, have the courage to be vulnerable and just be like, yeah, I'm here. I'll talk with you about it. You know, we'll walk through this together. You're not alone.
Seth, this is so good. And I'm glad that I closed it out with that question, because I think you shared a lot in there, especially give what you need. What did you need at that moment for you? Now give that. And you can't trust everybody, or you can't tell everybody, but you got to tell somebody. And also, don't be afraid of people. People are not going to ask you about the details of it. You know, even the people coming to me, they don't ask me about the details of it. But exactly what you just said, they want to know, how did you have the courage to be able to come out and be able to share your testimony? And that's exactly what you're going to do if you're that man going through that. And as you said, I thought about this, you know, and I'm so glad. I mean, I'm so thankful. I can't thank you enough, Seth, for coming on the show. And by the way, if you're tuning into the show late or catching the end of it, I'm talking with lead pastor at Maple Park Alliance Church in Quesnel, British Columbia. I'm talking to Pastor Seth Shelley. And we had a great discussion today about dealing with male sexual abuse and the stigma that's attached to it and the healing that God promised us through that. And Seth, what's amazing as you were sharing is you're talking about how with the church and you were looking for someone. Man, I realize now I've been attending church for over, I guess it had to be at least 46, 45 years of going to church. And I'm talking about several different churches because I moved around, you know, not one sermon, not one time has this ever been mentioned from the pulpit. Not once. Seth, that seems almost impossible. And I'm talking about you're talking about 45 years, you're talking about at least maybe, because, you know, when you're a college student, you're floating around, you're talking about at least 10 churches. And not to mention all the churches I've visited over the course of those years, not one time has this been brought up and talked about as a topic. And I told you how long it took for me to get someone like you on this show. So, brother, I want to thank you for joining us today and being so gracious with your time. And Seth, if you don't mind, quickly for us, I know you get bombarded because of the TED Talk and now because of our show. But if they wanted to reach out to you, If they had additional questions, what is the best way for them to contact you?
They can just go to my website, SethShelley.com.
Okay. And spell Shelley for us, so they'll have the correct spelling of that.
S-H-E-L-L-E-Y. And so on my website, there's different links to different, a few different things, some of my blogs, and I need to put a little bit more time into it. I haven't upgraded it as of recent. My wife's expecting our fourth child, so I've been a little busy.
Congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations. You know, but at least they have a way, because through your website, I'm sure they can email you through that as well. And so, great. And what we'll do is we'll put that in the show notes so they'll have a way of contacting you. And guys, quickly, and this is for our listeners out there, you guys, tell us what you thought about this show. Obviously, it's personal to me, and it's been a blessing to me, and Seth has been a blessing to have on the show. But let us know what you think, and please do us a favor, and this is so important. Take about 30 seconds to go over to iTunes and rate the program for us, because it's the best way to help us get a program like this in the hands, ears, and hearts of men just like you. Just think about it for a second. How many men, if one out of every six men are being sexually abused as children and nobody's talking about it, how important is this show for someone out there who's struggling with this? And now you have an opportunity. You don't have to have all the words to say to them. All you got to do is share this episode with them. So please don't keep us a secret. Share us with your friends. Share it with the people who you know you can be a blessing to. So until next time, I'm Joe Martin, your man builder with RealMenConnect.com, reminding you that we are males by birth, but we are men by choice. So each and every day, choose to be the man of God that he's called and created you to be, because a male is a terrible, terrible thing to waste. So until next time, stay strong, stay blessed, and as always, stay in God's grip.
Thank you for listening to the Real Men Connect podcast with Dr. Joe Martin. Real Men Connect isn't just a podcast. It's a mission, ministry, and movement to help good men become the great men God called and created us to be. And the best is yet to come. So if you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and leave us a review in iTunes. It really helps us to build the podcast and to reach, teach, and impact more men, all for the glory of God. And make sure you check out RealMenConnect.com to get our free tools and resources to help you go from good man to great man God's way. Again, that's RealMenConnect.com. Thank you for listening. We'll see you in the next episode.
If you or a man you know has been a victim of sexual abuse and you're finally ready to get rid of the shame and the guilt that has kept you in spiritual and emotional bondage, please personally and confidentially email me at realmenconnect@gmail.com so we can set up a private time to talk. That's realmenconnect@gmail.com. And just let me know you heard this show and you want to talk. Remember, God loves you, and there's freedom and victory on the other side of shame, guilt, and secrecy.